recreating the true sound and spirit of the human voice. Jules is an 18-year-old postman who's entranced by her voice and records it by sneaking a Nagra into a concert. Following the performance, he enters her dressing room and steals her gown. That same day, a former hooker, who knows that she's about to be murdered, records a confession onto a cassette that implicates several men of stature in an extraordinary scandal. This tape is slipped into Jules's bag, although he doesn't know he has it. He's pursued by punks trying to capture the cassette of the confession to prevent public knowledge of the dirty deeds revealed on the tape. At the same time, two thugs from a pirate record company are trying to steal Jules' cassette of the diva so that they can mass-produce and market it. With two pair of violent crazies pursuing him, Jules meets the diva and also meets a post-Godard-type couple who rescue him from wild chases and near encounters with death. Diva is a new wave film both in terms of French new wave cinema and also in its punk new wave sensibility. My guest, Wilhelmina Fernandez, was born in Philadelphia and lives in Philadelphia. She became internationally known when she sang the role of Bess on Broadway with the Houston Opera Company and toured Europe in the Houston production of Porgy and Bess. She made her Paris opera debut in 1979 in the role of Musetta in La Boheme. And this season, she will sing or has already sung Musetta with the New York City Opera. And next season, 82-83, she'll sing Donna Elvira in Don Giovanni. And I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. I so thoroughly enjoyed your performance and enjoyed your film. And I'd like to give our audience a chance to hear your singing before we talk. So let's just listen now to the aria that Wilhelmina Fernandez sings in the film Diva. And this is from the opera La Valle, written by Alfredo Catalini.
Oh,
The aria from La Wally, which is featured in the film Diva and sung by my guest Wilhelmina Wiggins Fernandez. And the film Diva will open this Friday at the Ritz Theater on 2nd and Walnut Streets. Well, welcome again to Fresh Air. How did you get the part in this film? I know it's your first movie.
The very first movie. It was really quite amazing because I was already in Paris at the Paris Opera Company singing Musetta, as you mentioned, from La Bohème. And the director of the film, Jean-Jacques Benex, was at the performance of Bohème. He came backstage afterwards to congratulate me, to get the autograph, the whole bit. And he wanted to talk to me further about some other ventures that, you know, he thought he would have in mind. And I did meet with him, had a beautiful luncheon, and he offered me a part in a film. Well, at that, I immediately said, no, I mean, you know, I'm not for a film. I'm really for opera and wanting to stay in the live performance type situation in order to get the immediate response. And at that, he said, but it really would be good for you. It's, you know, it's a wonderful vehicle for publicity. They wined and dined me for another week and convinced me to do the film. And I'm very happy that I have done it now.
What was it that finally convinced you?
After reading the script two or three times, the first time after the initial reading, I said no. I did not want to be involved in it. And then it was further explained to me what he was really going after, which was to try and reach the populace and to introduce, it's a form of introducing the populace to opera in a kind of fun, you know, sort of way, because it is a fun film. And so I reread it and realized what he was looking for. And I thought I could really bring that aspect of the film, you know, to the film. So I agreed to do it.
What else did he tell you about what he was aiming for in the script and with the movie? Since so much of the movie is in the way it's shot and edited also, like a lot mm-hmm. of the rhythm is in that. And it's hard to read that on a page in a script.
Mm-hmm.
What else did he tell you?
It's kind of hard. He explained to me about the different characters and what they were going to be doing. However, I really don't even come in contact with them too much, and I would really be bringing the cultural aspect to it. I would be introducing culture to the masses because it would get to a lot of places that I probably could.
How does the film compare with the expectations that you had of it when you first signed on?
After the first screening of it, I was really afraid. I said, no, it's not going to go anywhere. Look at me. I'm terrible. I'm putting the wrong hand up, you know. But after, like, seeing it the second or third time, I said, it's fantastic, you know. My favorite part is the chasing. And it was a lot of fun working with everyone. Everyone turned out to be really very nice.
Well, you're the elegance and the beauty and the serenity of the film, although your character is very temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
Around everything, around your character is all this like violence and mayhem and crazy rhythms.
I'm the solid one in the film. I'm the sensible one.
What were you told about your character?
I was told that she was she had reached the height of her career. And all she had to do was to wave her hand and everything would be brought at her feet. That kind of esoterical, can I say, kind of creature. Someone to be awed and revered by her public now. And if she wanted to sing, she would. If she didn't, she didn't have to. And just to portray that character, to really portray a diva.
What did you do to get into that frame of mind?
I had to do a whole head study because basically I'm not really that kind of person. I try to be down to earth and just let, you know, one day come at a time and live it that way. What I did do was just really study other divas like Leontine Price, Maria Callas, and see what they did and kind of brought that into the character that I was trying to portray. But at the same time, my still kind of subtleness kept creeping in there, you know, the serenity of it all.
Great
basically calm. Yeah.
great opera singers do have this reputation for being very
temperamental. Oh, yes.
Do you think that's true of many great singers?
Yes. Yes. Because you don't always get all of your temperament out on stage. A lot of people think that's a form of releasing. You can get on stage and go through your tantrums and, you know, hit a high C and that'll just release everything. But it doesn't. You know, it helps, but it doesn't always, you know, prove to be that kind of ground.
What kind of physical presence were you striving for, and how did you attain it?
Well, what I was striving for is basically almost my physical appearance. I'm tall. I'm statuesque. And I stand very tall and very proud. I'm not ashamed of my height, which is 5'8". And I would hate to be walking down the street being that tall and be a slouch. So in essence, I didn't really have to go through a lot of physical exertion, you know, to do that.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the aria that you sing?
The aria, in essence, is speaking of a lady who is in love, and she cannot quite conquer her love. And she's singing this aria head into an avalanche, which is about to take place. And when she feels that she can no longer go on and she cannot really get her life's quest, which is her love, she walks into the avalanche and dies there, which might be a beautiful way to go.
The music of that aria, I think, is so haunting, and it works beautifully in the film. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the libretto fits into the film at all?
I believe so. I have to be perfectly honest with you and tell you I have not read much of the aria, of the opera. It's not one that's done very, very often because it is difficult to cast, I would imagine.
Do you know why it was chosen?
For a number of reasons. For that kind of haunting melody, it turned out to be one of the director's favorites. And then after I listened to it, it was so haunting to me that I said, that's what I want to do. And I had listened to something like 50 or 75 arias in choosing, but that was the one that really rang out the most.
So take it the director is a real opera fan?
He is now. In the beginning, he wasn't. But then in picking out the music for what he wanted for the film, for the entire film, he really became an opera fan and an opera buff, more so than I am, probably.
There is a lot of new wave music in the music that was written for the film. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think of opera in a new wave setting, which I think is basically what happens in this movie. Was that difficult for you to see together?
No. Opera should be, you know, it should be open to change. I mean, it's been so traditional so long. And I think it's kind of fun to introduce some of the new wave into it now. And in this aspect of it, I think it's working. You know, it might not work with already traditional standard opera. Certainly it would not. But in the newer works that are probably coming out, I think you might find a little more.
As you mentioned before, this was the first film that you've ever done. What was the difference between performing for the stage and the kind of performance that you do for the camera?
One thing on stage, you can sing and you can get the immediate response from the audience. And that's always very, very rewarding, very refreshing. On camera, once you're in front of the camera and it's documented, and you can't change it all the time. Sometimes in a live performance, if you're having a bad night, maybe you can fit in with some of the chorus or kind of lean on some of the other cast members. In film, you're up there for the take, for the grabbing, and it almost has to be letter perfect.
How many takes did you do during the aria sequences?
We didn't have to really do that many. We shot from different angles. So I think in all actuality, there might have been about 3. There was a lot of time devoted in just setting the cameras up to get the right kind of imagery they were going after. For actual singing, you know, I said, well, as many times as you want to do it, okay, I'll have to do it, you know, because I want it to be perfect too.
So the singing was done separate from the filming?
Yes, yes. We tried it both ways. We did go to London to make the recording, to make the soundtrack of it. And then once at the theater, we tried doing it live there, just the voice live, because the orchestra was already on tape. And I think we got the better quality from the tape version.
How did you learn to lip sync back to your own voice?
Right on the spot. It was different from anything I had ever done. And you're standing there and you're watching yourself and, you know, your lips are moving and nothing is coming out. It's strange. It's a strange sensation, a very strange sensation.
Did you find that your gestures were any different for the screen than they are on stage?
Now I see that they are. And I wish that I had listened to Jean-Jacques a little closer, because he wanted me to give more, because the aria was really calling for more. And at the time of the taping in London, I was giving one thing, but then on screen, I was afraid of giving too many gestures and just overemphasizing the point. And as it turned out, I could have given just a fraction more. And I regret that I didn't now.
Oh, I think that the restraint in it is part of the elegance of the scene.
Yeah. Well, at one point, I just really felt that I should have been giving more, and I really saw the difference afterwards. It was too late.
Would you sit down and see the rushes as you were filming? Or?
No, I would not do that.
Because you'd never seen yourself before?
I had never seen myself before, and I don't think I was afraid of the reaction. It was just something that I didn't want to see an unfinished product. I really wanted to see it in its entirety first. However, the last day of shooting, I was pulled in bodily to see just the last of the rushes that were done, and which was frightening to me.
What was frightening?
I said, oh, I want to do it over. And it was, it was already finished, for me. And I guess I was really getting into the swing of cinematography, being in front of the camera and filming. And I just had a different outlook then on movies and on making a film. And I just wanted to do it over. And he says, no, there's no more time. It's not in the budget.
It's funny because the role that you play is of a soprano who's never allowed her voice to be recorded, but ends up hearing a recording of it, and you had to go through the same thing she does in your own way.
Exactly. I was almost of the same mental attitude as Cynthia Hawkins is in the movie before actually getting serious about my art, about opera. I had always said, no, I don't want to make recordings. I mean, why do that? You have the instant response from the audience, and that's gratifying enough. And the mechanical aspects can never be what you can actually produce, on the spot. And now I'm on a complete 90-degree turnaround, Whatever contracts are out there to be gotten, I want to get. I want to get into recording. It is a way of documenting you can use all those to learn by.
Had you heard your voice before?
Oh yes, yes.
Do you use that as a learning mechanism?
You're here a singer and you have never heard yourself sing before. That's bizarre.
Do you use it as feedback as a way to?
Yes,
Make changes.
Make changes. You have to listen to yourself to know what to improve upon. And most of the lessons that I go to or coachings, vocal coachings, I try and tape. And I do use those tapes as a learning vehicle. Yeah.
The role that you play, just to try another comparison, the role that you play in the movie is of someone whose fans completely adore her, and your co-star in the film, Jules, sneaks in to see you several times. Do you have crazy adoring fans when you sing in an opera? And what are some of the ways you judge someone who's gotten backstage to see you?
I judge them as fans. There are a few that have been able to get to every last performance that I've sung. And I'm starting to see them through different eyes. I don't know whether, you know, I want to adorn them, you know, for being so caring and so loving of what I've been able to, you know, to get across to them, that I'm appealing enough to them that they would want to come see the performance a number of times. A few of them have gotten close enough to me where they can be critical enough, you know, of a performance and its corrective criticisms. And I thoroughly enjoy that kind of rapport with them. Not too many, but just a few. And, you know, I appreciate their honesty, and I appreciate their friendship where, you know, they feel close enough to me where they can, you know, say something like that to me and by me not, and not get offended, you know, by it, truly.
Does it ever seem a little crazy to you to be traveling around and having people follow you?
And have people follow me, yes. You know, you wonder, you know, why are they doing this? You know, it can't be for the voice alone, you know. I mean, I'm not a raving beauty. I'm not really of any high acclaim. But it's fun. I must say it's fun. Just on this past Sunday, I was parking the car in New York and getting out just to take a walk, and a gentleman stopped me after he had passed me, and he turned around and came back to me and he said, "Excuse me, but aren't you Wilhelmina Wiggins Fernandez?" And he remembered the whole entire name, and I said, "Congratulations, you remembered the name at least." And he had seen the film, and he said he was absolutely enthralled by the whole thing. You know, he thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'm sure that's going to be happening to you a lot now.
I think so, probably.
You have to speak a lot of French, but you play the role of an American singer who's in France, and you have a very American French accent when you speak. Is that the way you speak French, or?
Unfortunately, yes, that's the way I speak French. I've tried and tried to improve upon it. However, the American still sneaks in. French, as you may know, is a very difficult language, especially the French R. And the director, along with the producers, along with the French coaches that they supplied me with, and the professors, all worked on the French R. And I think I only ever got it right once during the whole course of the filming. But it's a language that it is difficult. I think I probably sing differently. You know, the French being sung is a lot differently than my spoken French.
So the director and all the coaches were trying to get you to speak better French?
A little. They didn't want to take away too much from it because I was supposed to be an American speaking French. So they weren't trying to get a perfect French dialect or anything like that, or accent. But I personally wanted to improve upon it a little.
But, so it's funny. I thought there was a certain amount of appropriate arrogance in the lack of self-consciousness with which you spoke French with a heavy American accent. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare that you see an American speaking such Americanized French in a movie, you know, aside mm-hmm. from myself, friends, and embarrassed tourists, you know. you don't really hear it. I just found that actually very, very interesting.
Well, that was a point that I was considering before I had agreed to do the film, that it was going to be in France, spoken in French, and here I am, an American. And the French audience can be very, very testy about their language or about their culture. And I did not want to trample on any toes or make any instant enemies, you know, because I did have an already existing career there, and I didn't want to harm it, you know, in any way. But I took a chance and hoped that they would love me in spite of it, you know.
What kind of chemistry did you have with Jules, who plays opposite you, who's 18 in the film?
Yes. It was a very, very nice relationship. Wonderful to work with. A very bright person. He was sweet, kind, gentle. Always, almost like in the film, he was bringing me hot tea or hot coffee or something all the time. He was tremendous in helping me with French. He himself was already established as a French actor in France, And so therefore, he was giving me a few pointers and, you know, not where, just where to stand and kind of on profile and, you know, things like that. Very encouraging, because he knew I was petrified about the French, but he just said, just speak, you know, don't worry about it. And he, too, became a lover of opera. So we kind of switched off. I gave him a little insight on opera, and he gave me more insight on French. So it worked very well.
Were there any scenes that were cut that you were sorry are not in the film?
A few. There's one scene in particular during the course of the interview scene. At the end of that scene, there's another whole long speech, which I say to one of the reporters who's asking me a question. And that really had a lot to deal with how I felt about the art, how I felt about recording, and a little bit about divas being a person who is capricious and always wanting their way and being very temperamental. And I kind of missed that. There was also a scene that was cut that led into a little more of the friendship that had built up between Cynthia and Jules. That was cut. And I think it probably would have, I don't know, helped the continuity of the film a little had that been left in.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Wilhelmina Wiggins-Fernandez, who stars as the soprano in the film Diva that will open this Friday at the Ritz Theater in Philadelphia. When did you start to sing opera?
At a very young age, I'm going to say. I had my first semi-professional, really amateur concert at age 13. And that was held along with my mother, who is an organist, at my home church, which is Tasker Street Baptist Church. And that was my first recital with her. I had always been introduced to music by my mother, being a musician herself, and a lot of classical music was always being played at home. And upon entering junior high school and then consequent into high school, I was encouraged by both junior high school and high school teachers to really pursue a classical music career, mainly a concert, you know, opera/opera career. And I did that. I found that attending opera at an early age really enlightened me to other, you know, kinds of music other than pop and rock and roll, that kind. And I enjoyed listening to it. I was the odd one on the block.
Very few kids like opera. Yeah. At least in my neighborhood, very few did.
Yeah. And in mine, it was the same. I mean, there were some times where I really wanted to listen to some pop and, you know, wanted to pop my fingers and do that. But I always found myself coming back, you know, to classical music. I always found myself always wanting to go to the opera and seeing the performers on stage, the live performance again, you know, and just the glamour of it all. Because it seemed like at the age of 13, it seemed like such a glamorous life to live. You know, you're in costumes. You're in makeup all the time, and you're acting on stage. And I just had one of those kind of voices that was a little bit ahead of its time with high notes. I knew I could sing very high. Nobody else in school could do that. So I wanted to see how high I could go and how far I could take it. And the teachers really were guiding lights for me, and they directed me in the ways to go.
It's maybe gotten a little easier now, but it's been very difficult, I think, for black opera singers to find roles and stages to sing on. Were you ever discouraged from going into opera because of the lack of places for black performers to work?
At one point, I was very discouraged. And, you know, I don't want to go into name-calling, but I was very discouraged. But after a long talk with my parents, who were at that time were not really sure that's what I wanted to do. I knew then that's what I wanted to do, but you know, my mother encouraged me very strongly to just stick with it, and don't let that one obstacle, you know, remain in your way. If it's for you to have, you know, I would have it. And so I just stepped over that little stepping stone and just kept on going. You know, the opera field has opened in the last 10 to 20 years very, very much for black women, surprisingly enough. But
not for black men?
But not for black men.
What's the difference? You know?
I'm still toying with that myself. I hate to keep putting it on. It's just that the culture is not able to accept it yet. But it always goes back to that, that the American culture is not ready to accept the black male, you know, against the white prima donna yet. In Europe, I think it's a little more readily accepted. In fact, I know it is readily accepted than here.
Oh, I understand. Mm-hmm. Your performance made a sensation in Paris when you first performed there.
Yes.
There,
yes, it did.
There is a kind of history, I think, of black American performers going to Paris and mm-hmm. Getting incredible acclaim and appreciation there. And some stay, and mm-hmm. others return and see if it carries
if
over
it
at all.
Over, exactly.
But particularly in the 20s when it was hard to perform and get a lot of respect mm-hmm. in the States, I think a lot of people went to Paris. Yes. Is that still much of a phenomenon?
All I can say is that in the European culture is so much different than the Western culture here. And they're more readily able to accept talent. I don't think they're looking so much at color. I mean, color does come into play, but they accept talent as it is. They enjoy, you know, good talent and, you know, just the performer as a whole person. And they don't let, you know, color get in the way so much as they do here in the States.
Are European opera fans and opera goers much different from American ones, even in the way they show their appreciation at a performance and mm-hmm. the kinds of, even the atmosphere at the opera performance?
The average opera goer, I'm finding, in Europe are really, I'll say middle class kind of people, and they have really worked to save up their money, you know, to buy that ticket to go to the opera. It's very expensive there. And so they don't want to be cheated. And you have to give them, you know, all of you. You just can't give them a little bit. You know, they want all you have to give plus a little bit more. And here I really think the artist is kind of taken for granted because there are so many artists here. And a lot of them are very, very good. But at the drop of a hat, if someone gets sick, they can pick up a phone and, you know, just call Equity or something, and you're replaced immediately. There's no problem. There's always somebody standing in the wing to step in if you get sick. So, you know, so don't catch cold, don't break a leg, or don't do anything like that. But in Europe, I just feel that you're just much more appreciated there. They pride themselves on being more culturally advanced, you know, and they will read up on the opera before coming. And a lot of them have histories of, I mean, really being opera fans. They have followed that opera circuit for years and years and years. And they have a lot of names to compare with. So they can say, well, you know, Sutherland sang like this tonight, but, you know, Collis sang it this way in 1963 or something like that. And they pride themselves on that knowledge and on their culture.
Has Pavarotti mm-hmm. mania affected the size of the audiences turning up for opera performances?
I believe so. I believe he knew exactly what he was doing when he went commercial on everyone. You know, it was a way to intrigue the people just enough to, well, let's see what this opera mania is all about. And, you know, buy a ticket and, you know, let's go see it. Even if they never go to another one, at least they, you know, sprung for the first opera, per se. But I think he knew exactly what he was doing.
It's funny because in a way he really fits the physical stereotype of the old-fashioned opera singer who's very large and mm-hmm. you need that for resonance or so people thought.
So people thought, exactly.
And you're exactly not like that. I mean, you're thin and tall and really elegant. Mm-hmm. Are people ever surprised that your voice comes out of you?
Very. Very. They said, you're so, you know, well, you're tall and you're thin. How do you produce such a sound? And I said, well, I don't know. It's just there. And why do I have to be 300 pounds before I can sing? I mean, that's obscene. And, I mean, would you really prefer to see a 300-pound soprano walk out on stage? Or, you know, and in this day and time, I really believe that you have to give people the whole package. You know, they want to see the physique, you know, on stage anymore. And with the new wave, let's say, of directors that are out there, they're having you do all kinds of acrobatics now in opera. A lot of things that if you were heavy, it would be dangerous for you.
What kind of things?
So, I had one director, if I say the opera, he'll know what I'm talking about. I had one director who had informed my leading man to slap me, and I was supposed to fall down backwards on stairs, which I absolutely, you know, did not agree to do because it just was not safe, you know, to do for one thing. But in, like, say, for instance, in the opera, Porgy and Bess, with Houston's production, there was a lot of physical just tugging and pulling. There was a lot of groundwork where I was crawling across the floor. And, you know, if you have to lug a lot of weight around on your knees, that could be very, very dangerous. You can tear ligaments and everything else. And I just think for the splendor of it all, I want to look neat and, you know, kind of nice in my costumes. I don't want to be busting out all over, let's say. But and people are looking at that. I really think people are looking at it. Yeah. And also this, you know, the 1980s, 1970s have been so exercise conscious, you know, people and staying thin and nutrition. You have to watch what you eat. You have to exercise and do all of that.
What's your regimen to keep in the type of shape you need to be for a performance?
I vocalize every day, which I didn't used to do. But now I'm getting older. The voice is maturing. And I'm finding that it does take every day, you know, everyday work on it to keep it at the pace it's at. I don't jog. I am a walker, though. I do walk a great deal. I try and get out to walk about 3 times a week. And I usually walk... I try to get up to about 3 miles, which is not a whole lot, but it's enough for me. My daughter and I go bike riding. She likes to bike ride. And that's about it. I used to kid myself in telling myself that I couldn't eat before a performance. I know a lot of singers still don't. And depending on what performance I'm doing, it determines on whether or not I eat a big meal or just a light meal. I do eat at least 2 or 3 hours before a performance. And I might take juice, you know, to the theater with me to just give me a little food or two, a little more stamina if I need it. But now I'm finding that I do need the substance of a good balanced meal, a good solid meal in my system before performing.
You said your voice is maturing. What are the changes that you notice with it?
I'm noticing that the lower register is really starting to grow. I'm letting it do that naturally. In the beginning, I used to try and force a lot of middle chest register and low notes, which was really mistakes on my part. And I should have known better, and now I'm just letting them go their natural way, let them just produce by themselves. So I'm finding that, you know, the lower register is indeed growing. And with that, the top register seems to be growing. Before, I would just vocalize perhaps up to a high C, maybe a C sharp. Now I'm vocalizing up to E naturals, which I never would have attempted years ago,
so
about 3 years ago.
Your range really does grow as you get older?
Yes, it does grow. Yes, it should grow.
That's so exciting, considering that there's many things where your options are limited as you get older.
They are limited,
like as a dancer.
But I think you, it's all with training. I mean, some roles I wouldn't do at age 22 as I would do at age 32. And you have to wait for the voice to mature to do those. Otherwise, you will be running into vocal difficulty and you're asking for trouble. I personally want a long career. You know, I want to be singing when I'm 60, you know, 65 or so. And I think, you know, in using good judgment about the roles that I do and not pushing the voice too much, you know, stretching it out of proportion right now, will enable me to be singing, you know, much later in life.
Well, Amina Fernandez is my guest, if you're just joining us, and she's the star of the new film Diva that will be opening this Friday in Philadelphia. You're from Philadelphia, and I just learned before this interview that you actually are still based in Philadelphia, even though, granted, you spend a lot of your time touring and singing in Europe. Well, how would you characterize the Philadelphia opera scene?
It's growing. Philadelphia Opera, I believe, is in its fourth year now, I think, third or fourth year. And I feel it's growing, and it's going to be on the caliber of the New York City Opera, the Metropolitan, and perhaps San Francisco Opera. I have not yet sung there, because they are taking in a lot of international artists, but I, too, am now international. But I, at this point, I just feel it's just a matter of becoming probably more well-known around Philadelphia and just getting my name out there. You know.
Do you think you'll stay in the city?
Oh, yes. Yes, I enjoy Philadelphia. Like you said in the beginning, I was born here, and I received my initial education here, and Philadelphia to me is my kind of refuge. You know, touring Europe in different operas for, I don't know, about 3 months out of a year, and then you come back and you come to the States and you're touring another 5 months, you know, in different operas. You really kind of need a little recluse to yourself. And Philadelphia has proven to be that for me. You know, I'm comfortable living in South Philadelphia.
Do you think it will be as easy to be a recluse in South Philadelphia once your movie is out?
Yes, I do. I live a very quiet life, very quiet existence. The neighbors are just now starting to wake up a little bit about who is living in the block, you know, with them. But they're not, I mean, they're not bothering me. They're very cordial, you know, and I get out and I wash my car right along with them, and it doesn't faze them at all. Last Friday after one of the screenings, I came back with some of the brochures and, you know, passed them out. And they asked me to sign autographs, and they said, you know, why do I have to sign? I live right across the street. You know, you can see me anytime. But it's kind of fun for them. But I think they are respecting, you know, my privacy. You know.
Is there a role that you would most like to sing if you could choose one?
If I could choose one, I probably would really be tossing up between Leonora from Il Trovatore or Tosca. You know, those are about two on the list right now that I really want to get into. I've looked at them. I don't feel at this point that I should be singing them, but it's time for me to begin looking at them, and perhaps in another 2 to 3 years, I will probably undertake one or the other and try it out and see how it goes and put it down and do some more study on it and pick it up again.
Are there new composers whose work interests you?
Well, right now, the work of Gavin Bryars is interesting me a lot because I am working on a world premiere of a new Medea that will be premiering in Venice in September. And his writing is really unique. It's contemporary. It's different. I really haven't been able to really categorize it yet. But you know, I'm looking forward to seeing more of it. I know he's done a lot already, but I haven't really sat down and really analyzed it yet. But it's different.
Can you just give us an idea of how you approach a role when you get it, how you learn the part, and Mm-hmm. How you divide it up so you can really understand it and figure out how you're going to sing it.
Mm-hmm. Would you want me to talk about the Madeo or something that's really kind of standard now, or just in general?
Maybe something that's standard because people would have something to compare okay. it to.
Well, you buy the score, you look through it, and a lot of singers will buy a recording and listen to the recording, which I do. I will listen to the recording, and I mark in my score to myself what may be a danger point, either vocally or dramatically. And I also mark out resting spots in case I get into trouble, where I can rest, where you can kind of hold back. I then basically learn the melody. If it's a new work or, you know, I really get to the piano and just pound out notes until I become almost bored with it. I then take on the text. I read through the text and try and get a flow of how the rhythms should be with the language, especially with Italian, because Italian is a very fluid language. It's liquid, and it has to flow one word into the other, or it sounds like you're speaking bad French. and once I feel I have the rhythm of the words, I put the words to the actual rhythm of the music, and then I begin to memorize. And I look up as much work or as much background on the character that I am undertaking and do a little bit of, you know, insight on that, get a little research done on that.
Do you ever, like, yeah. do you take it, like, line by line or aria by aria? How far do you break it
down? Line by line, yes. My Italian dictionary is my Bible, almost, when it comes to translating music. You have to have it there. And I take it word for word and just get a literal translation of it first. And then, you know, if something puzzles me, I can go back to the libretto.
Do you musically take it line by line also?
Yes. Yes. First of all, you should really learn it musically correct, as square as possible. And then once you learn it and become more comfortable with it, I think then you can take some liberties. But the initial learning process should be as accurate as possible.
What kind of music do you listen to in your spare time?
Spare time?
If you have any.
Roberta Flack. Bill Withers. I like Chopin. I'm a dear, dear lover of Chopin. So I listen to that a great deal. Having a 9-year-old in the house, she likes classical music. But at some point, she does get tired of it. And that's understandably, you know, so. And she will listen to the Jackson 5 or Michael Jackson, their recordings. She's their fan right now, yeah. And that's about it. I thoroughly enjoy piano music, though.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us, and I want to wish you the best of continued luck with your career and tell you again how much I enjoyed your performance in Diva. Wilhelmina Wiggins-Fernandez has been my guest, and she's from Philadelphia, and you'll be able to see her on the screen starring in the film Diva. It opens in Philadelphia this Friday at the Ritz Theaters on 2nd and Walnut Streets, and you'll be performing also at the City Opera in New York in
Next spring. I will. Mm-hmm. I'll be doing the role of Micaela from Carmen, and also the Donna Elvira from Don Giovanni.
Well, good luck, and thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
Let's listen to the reprise from the aria from La Valle that is performed in the film Diva. And this is the reprise from the soundtrack of the film.
Thank you.
The aria from La Vallée from the soundtrack of the film Diva, performed by Wilhelmina Wiggins Fernandez with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Kosma. Well, it's 26 minutes to 4, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Coming up in about a half hour on Fresh Air, I'll be joined by one of the leading military historians in America, Russell Weigley, who is a professor of history at Temple University and has written many books on military history. His most recent one has been nominated for an American Book Award, and that one is called Eisenhower's Lieutenants. His earlier books include A History of the United States Army and The American Way of War. So that's coming up in a half hour. Well, every Tuesday at this time, we feature Jazz Revisited with Hazen Schumacher, and today's subject is extended recordings by Glenn Miller and Jazz at the Philharmonic.
One of the first on-the-spot jazz recordings. It was in 1944, the Jazz at the Philharmonic group doing Body and Soul. I'm going to play that, a few others, on today's program, Extended Recordings.
Jazz Revisited. Revisited, a review of the first three decades of recorded American jazz, 1917 to 1947, the artists and their music, a program produced at the University of Michigan. Here is your host, Hazen Schumacher.
As usual on these programs that we title Extended Recordings, we try to play some of the recordings from the period we're considering in Jazz Revisited that are longer than the usual one side of a 10-inch record, which runs around 3 minutes, or one side of the old 12-inch 78s, 4.5 to 5 minutes. They handled that in a variety of ways in the 78 era. And on this program, I think we're going to hear, three different ways that it was handled. The first one, for example, is two sides of a 78, the same number continued from one side to another. In this case, we're playing from a later LP where they spliced it together nicely so that you didn't even know it was two sides. Then we're going to play several sides of a Jazz at Philharmonic where when it came out, and when this recording came out in 78, version was four sides of a 78, an attempt to put together a live concert that way, which was very difficult when you were playing it back in those days. And then the final one is, again, two sides of a 78, but in that case just linked by a theme of two different compositions, but linked by a theme. So those are examples of how they tried to do it in the 78 era. The first one is the Glenn Miller recording of the Anvil Chorus from Verdi's opera Il Trovatore. It's interesting why he recorded this number. This was in a day when the Metronome magazine in December 1940 said, starting December 1, only non-ASCAP tunes may be played on the three major networks. The broadcasters are experimenting with a complete BMI program schedule and trying to get the public used to non-ASCAP music before the December deadline. This was in 1940. There's a big hassle between the composers and their group, ASCAP, American Society of What? Composers, Authors, and Publishers, I guess, and the networks. So there was... What was happening is that a lot of the groups, and Glenn Miller was one of them, were not only playing new music that was not ASCAP, but also digging back into the old stuff, and in this case, going to the classical composers to come up with the material. There's some it's good Billy May trumpet on one side of this, and then there's some, I think, good Ernie Caceres clarinet on another. It was arranged by Jerry Gray. Glenn Miller and his orchestra, The Anvil Chorus, 1 and 2, December 1940. Thank you. Take that, Giuseppe Verdi. That's the Anvil Chorus done by the Glenn Miller Band. Two sides, originally two sides of an old 78. Victor did a pretty good job of putting it together. I have to listen very carefully to see where the difference was in the two sides on the original issue. Okay, now next is something different. This is the Jazz at the Philharmonic, originally a live concert recorded on the spot. I don't know, this was